My name is Jody Kretzman, and I come from Chicago, where, among other things, teaching and doing stuff in the neighborhoods, I've done a lot of work with Harold Washington, who was Chicago's first black mayor, and bring to this discussion a set of biases and commitments, I think, that should be on the table from the beginning. I think that even in the seventh year of the Reagan administration, when a lot of the national scope of what we think of as politics in America has been defined as a rightward drift, a shrinking public sector, increasing reliance on the private sector for a variety of public ends, that invisibly, or at least barely visibly, to lots of white America, there's been a counter trend going on during these years. And to me, it's the terrifically exciting and hopeful end of political life in America these days. So I want to briefly this morning do a couple of overview kinds of commentaries with you, and hopefully we can talk then a little bit about where political life, particularly as it is related to race, is going in the United States. I talked a little bit the other day about the dimensions of the growing inequality in the United States, the economic dimensions of our social justice problem. I think I tried to paint a picture of the United States, in fact, as an increasingly unfair set of social relationships. That is, that all of the measurements seem to indicate that after a time of leveling off in all the categories of measuring equality during the 1970s, that since about 1978, and certainly since 1980, the gap between black and white has been growing, the gap between wealthy and poor has been growing, and therefore that we have some urgent unfinished business from the point of view of Christians interested in social justice. Some thought that that session the other day ended on a hopeless note, on a note of not knowing exactly what to do about forces that seem a lot bigger than any of us can have an effect on. So in another context then, this morning is for me a sharing of some of the hope that I have. I also need to say that it seems to me that if you read the history of the United States from the perspective of an interest in social justice, that it has been clear for the last 150 years that the weight of moral leadership has fallen on the shoulders of the black community. That if you need to find a place where an ethical approach to the redoing of society is being thought through and led, it has always, in various eras of history, been the black community that has articulated that vision of social justice and that has carried the weight of leadership. In my own view, that's as true today as it ever has been. And in fact, the one way of thinking about the polarization of political life in the United States is to think about the Reagan White House, where 19 out of 400 of his top appointments have been black. The gulf between life in Washington, D.C. and life in black communities across the United States is another way of thinking about the growing gap, it seems to me, that characterizes United States society at this point. Well, lots of folks in the black community talk these days about a new black politics, and that's mostly what I want to concentrate on. But we need to do first a little bit of recalling together of the history of political life as it's been experienced by the black community in the United States before we turn to the state of black politics today. And then think a little bit about the centrality of black mayors to the black political resurgence, and then think together a little bit too about what difference it all makes, and particularly how white and black interact on this stuff. Okay, that's sort of where we're going. It's always instructive to to begin by recalling that blacks came to this country as non-persons, that they had no political status or public status at all, that they were chattel, property, and that the construction of a public life by the black community from that perspective was an invention out of nothingness, right? There was no agreed upon status given black folks when they got here. We don't have to rehearse the entire emancipation movement, only to recall that none of the emancipation movement leading into the Civil War, particularly as black folks participated in that movement, none of that had anything to do with public office holding, with positions that were ratified by the state. That in fact it was not until post-emancipation or Reconstruction days in the South when black folks first moved into elective political office in really quite significant numbers across the South, if you remember, right after the Civil War, for that decade and a half. Then to recall that the fears of blacks going to Washington, D.C. in the Congress and beginning to take over both local municipal and county governments and even beginning to make moves on state government in the South, that those fears led to a clamping down in the form of all kinds of restrictive legislation as the apparatus of Jim Crow segregation got set up. And Reconstruction was stopped dead in its tracks after flourishing for about a decade and a half or so. And then really, from the end of the 19th century till 1965, blacks, particularly in the South, were effectively locked out of public life in the United States. The Northern story is a little bit different, but is really not, doesn't really in lots of ways form a major exception to the lockout. The major turning point in black political life, now we're getting into the modern era, was of course in 1965, with the passage after years of pressure in the civil rights movement, 1965, the passage of the Voting Rights Act, right? So all of political history from the black point of view can be read, modern political history can be read as pre and post Voting Rights Act, 1965. It is the key piece of legislation that has determined the participation of blacks in political life in the United States. It's instructive, you know, we think about the Voting Rights Act when we think about it at all as being a kind of, as being a central turning point in the United States that has national implications, but we do forget sometimes that the Voting Rights Act affected really only seven states. It was aimed specifically at the Deep South states where in our naivete in 1965, we thought that most of the injustice of racism was concentrated. Since then, of course, the basic tenets of the 1965 Voting Rights Act have been extended in decision after decision at the Supreme Court level to all kinds of jurisdictions, right? So basically now, the Voting Rights Act is national in scope, and it's impossible to erect the kinds of barriers that were legally erected that kept blacks from voting in the South before 1965. My own entry, by the way, into this stuff was in the summer of 1964 when, as a college student, I went down to Mississippi to as part of what was called then Mississippi Summer 1964. It was organized by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It was an effort to register black folks, and it was a life-changing summer for me in lots of ways. Not the least of which is that, you know, it was my first experience of living entirely in another culture. That is, white folks were the enemy for anybody who was coming down to help in this particular drive, and living in the midst of the black community and working only in a black context sort of turned the world upside down for me in lots of ways. But the absolute impenetrability of the walls between public life and the black community just was hammered home to me in all kinds of ways. Probably the most frightening way was after taking a couple of very, very courageous older black ladies into Greenville, Mississippi to to register to vote under the armed guard of the Justice Department at that time. They were sort of surrounding the courthouse for this registration drive. We went through all of the tests, including, you know, at that point blacks were sometimes asked to quote from different parts of the Constitution in order to be qualified to vote. It was like a Trivial Pursuit game, sort of, that blacks had to go through to be registered. But in fact, we had gotten copies of the test at this point, and these women had rehearsed their answers very well. In fact, they knew all of it and could quote the appropriate parts of the Constitution. And we're the first two blacks to be registered in Greenville at that point. We left the courthouse. It took about 5.5 hours to go through the whole process, and we left in an old Chevy, and were chased out of town by three pickup trucks with gunfire blasting out of the trucks, and we finally had to sort of cut off across a field to get into the backwoods enough to. And luckily, the guys were more interested in the look of their pickup trucks, and they sort of stayed on the highway and let us go across the field. But you know, at that time in the South, it was a very difficult. Very difficult turning point for the black community, and the kind of courage that it took for folks to begin to think about themselves as potentially actors in the political scene was just astonishing to me. Voting Rights Act was seen as a sort of major moral victory by the black community. Within the next 4 years, over 1 million new black voters were registered. In the South, in those seven states. Let's sort of get into now some of the current state of black politics. Before 1965, on a national level, there were under 200 black elected officials across the United States. We're talking northern cities as well as in the South. And since then, the story really is a both-and kind of story. There has been a terrific explosion in the number of black elected officials, so that from 200 in 1965, there are now over 6,500 black elected officials nationally. Over 6,500. That is one side of the story. Tremendous gains, and the percentages of the gains continue to happen year by year. In lots of different ways that we can talk about through the morning. But the other side of the story is that black political representation is still clearly an underrepresentation. It is not at all near what the black population is. And we've got a couple of things up here. I think that it's instructive to think about these kinds of statistics as both regional and state phenomenon, because it does vary from one part of the country to another. For instance, just thinking about the percentage of the black population, percentage of the national black population living in the Northeast, North Central, South, and West parts of the country. Over 50% of the black population nationally still lives in the South. I think we're counting about 14 states here, not the original seven. Then North Central, Northeast, and the West, including California, really is very low in terms of the numbers of black folks, percentage of the national population. One of the things that you can see is that these numbers are the percentage of black elected officials. That is, what percentage of the total 6,500 is from this particular region. One of the lessons from looking at these numbers, that is, the Northeast has 18% of the black population, 11% of the black elected officials. The West has 9% of the black population, 6% of the black elected officials. The correlation here between percentage of the black population and percentage of black elected officials, is there a conclusion you want to draw from that? I mean, it is highly correlated. It means that black folks elect black politicians, right? It means white folks don't, right? The other thing we can talk about is the fact that black folks elect not only a few black politicians, but an awful lot of white politicians. Black folks always have voted for white politicians. White folks have never voted for black politicians. So the racial patterns of voting are clear. Let's take a look at state by state. Sort of fun to think about. Blacks as percentage of the population of each of these states, and then blacks as the percentage of the elected officials in each of these states, okay? So that nationally, this is actually voting age population. The black population of the United States is about 12% of the 240 million or something like that. Voting age population, since the black community is a younger population, is about 10.5%, right? Blacks hold about 1.3% of the entire elected spots. So that this 6,500 is 1.3% of all of the elected officials in the country. Yeah?
Quick question. The percentage of blacks in the population, how many of those are registered voters?
The registration rates also vary by local conditions and regions. Generally, the rate of black registration, voter registration, is about 10% under the white rate nationally. But it varies, as you know, from Chicago's experience. It can skyrocket when there's interest, when there's some movement that seduces people in the political process. So that really varies widely from 80-85% in some places to under 50% in others. But generally, across the country, it's 10% under the white participation rate, and that's a problem. Just a couple of state statistics. Here we are in Washington, where 2.5% of voting age population is black, and 0% of the elected officials. That doesn't mean that there is none. It means that, let's see, what is it for Washington? Of 7,500 elected officials in Washington, 17 are black, okay? 17 out of 7,500 in the state of Washington. In Oregon,
you've got 6,500 total elected.
6,500 is the total of, that shouldn't be under that column. It's the total nationally of black elected officials.
That's how many black officials?
Nationally, right? And that is nationally 1.3% of the total for everything. Now by state, practically none in Oregon, practically none in Minnesota. I picked out a few key states for holding millage here. Oregon has only 1.2% of the population, but 10 of 8,000 elected officials are black. In Minnesota, 9 of 19,000 are black. Illinois I'd throw my own state and yours in, 13.6% of the population of Illinois is black and 1% of the elected officials. We however, have the distinction of being from a state that has the most elected officials. There are more jurisdictions that elect things in Illinois than in any other state, including New York, California, and so forth. So this 1% is a large number of black elected officials. It's just that we've got so many of those elected officials around.
Could you explain what that last column is as percent of
as the percent of
if
you
officials?
That's right. If you look at the whole, all of the 19, there are 19,000 total elected officials in Minnesota.
So
of those, 9 are black.
Don't really compare to each other exactly, since it's always the percentage of the state's number of.
Say it again.
Those percentages don't really compare in absolute value to each other, since just saying that you're 1% in Illinois.
That's right. The absolute numbers are different because the total number of officials is different. The percentages are not very impressive over here as percent of elected officials compared to the population percentages. It's interesting that in the old, just picked out a couple of the old South states here as examples, where the black population is still significantly you know, somewhere between a quarter or a third of the population is black. And you know, since there are two ways, you know, is a glass half empty or half full here, since 1965, tremendous gains in black elected officials throughout the South, but still 27% in Louisiana of the population and 10% of the elected officials, and similar kinds of ratios of population elected officials throughout the South.
So one thing where these statistics are a little misleading, though, is that in Illinois, the black population, by and large, is concentrated in the East St. Louis area and in Chicago.
Yeah.
So Chicago, we might have 4 million people living there. Maybe, and I'm just using general numbers, 3 million are black, but we only have one mayor. Whereas if the blacks were spread out over Illinois and they voted for black, then those percentages would rise greatly. So these are skewed.
That's right. That's right. There are local conditions. To some degree, they are. Although,
absolutely.
Although, the other side of your point, the other side of your argument is that it looks like the more you scatter the black population, the less political power the black population exerts. Right. So that if the Chicago black population was distributed through all of Illinois, somewhat equally, so far the results look like there wouldn't be any black elected officials. That is, you need a certain concentration of population, it looks like, from these numbers, for instance.
Yeah.
That would hold true for if 10% of the population were Republicans and the rest Democrats, there wouldn't be any Republicans elected.
Yeah.
Or Chinese or Hispanics.
Right.
So that would hold true for any group. They have power, well, you have to concentrate.
Yeah, all we're saying is that racial voting exists.
Oh, for sure.
Clearly. Yeah.
I just kind of cautious about that, too, because, like, on the Oregon statistics, probably 90% of the blacks in Oregon
Portland, huh?
live in Portland,
mm-hmm.
in maybe three neighborhoods.
That's right.
So if you've got 17 blacks elected in Portland, and I'm not sure if that's all where they are,
mm-hmm.
I think you've got a considerably different picture.
Yeah,
now,
absolutely.
Their statewide influence does not change.
That's right.
Okay, but in terms of their locality and how they're voting, I think you get quite a different picture.
Absolutely right. All of these qualifications, I think, are well taken. And we certainly could take the time to draw a much richer statistical picture. But in general, what I'm trying to say is that there's been some incredible progress since 1965. There is still an awful long way to go. And that the racial voting patterns of blacks voting for whites and blacks, but of whites voting just for whites, continues. Okay? Those are the sort of main points, I think, about where we are at this point. let me shift a little bit now to thinking with you and talking with you about the importance of black mayors, both in the South and in the North, as the sort of center of black political activity as it's getting redefined. And again, the context is that more and more black leadership sees the entire movement toward liberation and freedom as having moved from protest to program, from protest to electoral politics, in fact. So that the central momentum of the activity within the black community is increasingly defined as an electoral political kind of momentum. Very, very different from even 10, 15 years ago, and kind of accelerated. So let me think with you for a minute about black mayors. There are now over 500 black mayors in the United States. The ones that I want to think with you a little bit about most are the 28 black mayors, as of the end of 1986 anyway, the 28 black mayors who are mayors of cities over 50,000, okay, of the larger cities in the United States. And I want to think about the meaning of black political life as it's being expressed in black mayoralties in larger cities for just a minute, okay? Because it is affecting the way in which blacks interpret their life at this moment in the United States. The 500 black mayoralties in the United States is not a single story repeated 500 times. It really is a variety. It's 500 very different stories. But I've been trying to think about what are the patterns and how can we understand interactions between black and whites by thinking about the patterns that are emerging in our cities where, in fact, black folks have emerged as the most interesting political force. 1967 was the year that the first major cities elected black mayors. Remember who? Semi-trivia contest here?
Bradley?
No, not then. Dick Hatcher and Gary and Stokes in Cleveland, okay? And then the next year, Ken Gibson and Newark. Now you think about Gary, Cleveland, and Newark, New Jersey, right? What do they have in common? Absolutely. The first, really, if you had to pick three cities where the entire deindustrialization shift in the economy, where the entire decimation of blue-collar America hit first, you couldn't pick three better cities than Gary, Cleveland, and Newark, right? Absolutely collapsing economies. And those were the first three cities that elected black mayors. Most of the middle-class whites had left, or were leaving as the elections took place, or left directly after the election of those mayors. And most of the capital and jobs had left those cities, right? So that the first set of theories about the election of black mayors was that it's fine to elect blacks to political office as long as what they inherit is an empty shell, right? It was another way of defining a lose-lose situation for the black community. And those were the early thinking about black mayoralties was that you could not elect a black mayor, except in situations where the economy was already collapsed and a shell was inherited. That first set of perceptions about what was going on has been modified a lot in the subsequent election of the 500 plus mayors that have been elected since, and particularly in the 28 mayors of the largest cities. But the economic context still determines an awful lot of what a black mayor can do. And you've got a whole range of contexts that blacks can deal with. All the way from, on the one hand, your Newarks and your Garys, which are still a part of the black political scene, to an Atlanta or a Los Angeles or a Chicago, where the economy is more mixed, where there's a lot of poverty, there's a lot of growth of the underclass, but there's also a lot of economic life left there in those places. The economic context does determine an awful lot of what black mayors can do and how they approach their entire agenda in the public context. So first thing to think about, it seems to me, when we're thinking about patterns, is to think about the economic context. The second thing to think about when you think about patterns of black political power in cities is the racial context, and particularly the percent of the population of the city that is black. That determines an awful lot of what it is that emerges as a black political presence in that city. And that too is very different in the 28 cities that now have black mayors. What's the city with, would you guess, with a black mayor that has the lowest percentage of black population?
Los Angeles?
Exactly. 17% of Los Angeles is black, and it did elect Tom Bradley. Now that means something for the style of black politics and the content of black politics as represented by Tom Bradley, right? There are a whole range then of cities that have a black population somewhere between a third and a half. Somewhere between 35% and 50%. Chicago, Philadelphia are probably the two largest, where there's a tipping point, where the elections have been very close, where you don't have a situation where the majority of the population is black, So you tend to get mayors that have to build on more than the black community in order to win, okay? So that you get different kinds of mayors in Philadelphia and Chicago. We'll talk about that in a second. Then you go up to a group of cities that are now close to two-thirds black. Detroit, Washington, D.C. are probably the two, and Atlanta are the three most significant cities with about a two-thirds city population that is black. And that defines a different kind of context for what sort of black politics can get practiced, right? And then, of course, you get all the way down to the totally decimated cities like Newark or East St. Louis, I think, is the one with the largest percentage of black population that has a black mayor, and that's about 97% black, I think. But the racial context determines a lot about, again, the style and content of black mayors. Now let me talk about a couple of mayors as examples of what I'm talking about here, remembering that the economic context and the racial context determines a lot of this and that they don't have a lot of choices about some of this stuff. There is huge variation in what the black community talks about as race consciousness, among black mayors. Probably at one end of the spectrum would be a Tom Bradley, whose race consciousness in the terms used by the black community, it's very low indeed. He's run essentially as a non-racial candidate, right? As aracial, appealing to all colors and to all classes, essentially presenting himself as a manager and a technocrat, right? Colorless. The black community in Los Angeles has lots of trouble with Tom Bradley, and he's an ex-policeman. That's where he came up through the city bureaucracy as the police commissioner of Los Angeles. The relationships between the community of Watts, for instance, and other parts of black Los Angeles and Mayor Bradley have never been very close or very cordial, even. But he continues to win, and if he's going to win in that context, he really has to be the kind of politician that he is, right? Think then of slightly to the more racially conscious, but not very far, kind of politician. I would think about a Wilson Good in Philadelphia. Good, too, came up as a city bureaucrat. Thinks about himself and presents himself as a non-racial technocrat, sells himself as a manager, as someone who knows how to live within restricted resources, essentially knows how to manage a business, and thinks about city government as business. That approach, again, Philadelphia being a city that has 40% black population, that approach was the approach that Good took to get the extra 10%, 15% of votes that he needed to win, right? So he built his coalition by running as non-racial a campaign as he possibly could, okay? You then have a bunch of politicians in the two-thirds black cities, like Detroit, like Atlanta, like D.C., who run on a much higher level of race consciousness because they've got the constituency to appeal to, and they can do it, right? So you've got Andy Young, you've got Coleman Young, you've got Marion Barry in Washington, D.C., running very black campaigns, still trying to appeal beyond the black community, but knowing, in fact, that if they satisfy the majority of constituents within the black community, they can be elected. So that the development of a black political agenda is much more evident in those cities than it is in a Los Angeles or a Philadelphia. Yeah?
Just a quick question. In that second category where you've got 35% and 50%, what's the percentage of crossover vote? Is it almost 100% black voting for the black, non-black consciousness mayor and 10% coming from the white, or is there 10-20%
in both Philadelphia and Chicago, which are the two major examples of about a 40% black city,
okay,
right? In each of those cities, about 20% of the non-black vote has gone to the black candidate, right? And since both Washington and Good presented themselves as viable candidates within the black community, they got over 90% support from the black community. My own bias is, let me just put this in here for a second. My own bias is that Harold Washington in Chicago is the most interesting black politician in the United States at this point, because he has managed to run a highly race-conscious set of campaigns, appealing to the black community, developing a black agenda. Remember, I'm coming from a point that argues that the black community has always defined the moral reality for the United States. And at the same time, he is operating in a city where he has to build, from that black agenda, enough support from other communities, whites, Latinos, Asians, that he goes over the 50% mark. So it seems to me that on a national scale of sort of interesting and rich combinations of political possibilities, that Washington has taken the hardest route and succeeded, and therefore has pushed the black political agenda at the national level forward further than any of the other mayors. The other thing that he's got going for him that makes his platform, he's got a number of other things going, platform most interesting in a national context, is that Chicago is still a more or less viable economy, and that there's enough resources to work with to be able to experiment not only with a policy agenda that is national in scope, but also one that can redo politics and policies locally. So the race consciousness and that context, I think, is terrifically important. The final set of variables, it seems to me, is to add on some indication of political ideology. And I've talked a little bit about that in the context of the pragmatists, the technocrats that are elected in Los Angeles and Philadelphia most easily at this point. But yeah.
I just want to two comments. Number one, in the case of Wilson Good, if I remember right, his opponent in the election was a racist.
Rizzo.
I mean, it was just, if I'm right, and I, of course, don't live in Philadelphia, so, but if I remember right, he was the one to bring up, because he was a former police commissioner or chief of police or something like that.
Yeah, and fairly flat out about it.
And also, what? I think in the case of Bradley, do the blacks consider him an Oriole?
Well, you know, he considers himself a non-racial politician. And I think that insofar as black leadership is interested in defining a black political agenda for the nation, they don't look to Tom Bradley for leadership.
More for everybody rather than,
I think in a sort of narrow technical management sense, he is. In terms of envisioning a different kind of politics, I don't think he's very relevant. Right? There are at least those two things going on always when you're thinking about politics. And I'm a little bit more interested in, again, in the black community as a carrier of a different vision for our public life, right? As they have been throughout history. And as I'm arguing now, they are through the electoral political arena. So that the political ideological positions of these mayors vary considerably from a Bradley on the one hand, narrow, technocratic, really non-ideological, in the way that most mainstream American politicians are, right? We are the most non-ideological country in the world, you know, bar none. Virtually, you know, our parties don't stand for very much. In no other country in the world do we have this kind of amalgam of interests that get thrown into a political party, right, without any particular consistent political ideology. That is, a consistent set of goals and interests that get expressed. Black politics, too, has their practitioners who are sort of in the mainstream of the American mold, non-ideological, just pragmatic managers, technocrats, and that's the kind of, and there's, you know, there's certainly something to be said for that. I don't find it very exciting from a social justice point of view. There are a lot of black, there are increasing numbers of black politicians who I think are developing a much more consistent, in the European sense, ideological set of directions. Again, it seems to me that Harold Washington is probably the most developed in that way, probably because of his years in Congress and his leadership in the United States Congress of the Black Political Caucus, which, by the way, I think the Black Congressional Political Caucus is at the national scene, for me, the most interesting leadership group to follow. I think that they consistently take the most thoughtful positions from a social justice point of view of any public figures in the country. So Washington comes out of that. This is not just left-right that I'm talking here. It's a sense of consistency that connects local issues to a much broader context. You know, one of the things that's interesting about working with Washington is that he has been a consistent advocate for reducing expenditures in the arms race. He has been a consistent sort of peace congressman. His foreign policy stuff carries forward into the South Africa arena particularly, but also Central America stuff. The emergence of a black oriented foreign policy that gets carried by people who are more ideologically oriented in the way that I'm talking about it. For the black folks who have a more ideologically oriented view of life, it also carries a kind of faith in the public sector, which is directly contradictory to what we get in the Reagan years mostly, right? They really do think that the public sector is important, that government can do things. Not that government has always done things right, or that there's not a lot of stuff to be changed in the public sector, but they do have a real belief that the state has a positive role to play, particularly in pushing forth the questions of social justice. That belief seems to me, you know, as you look across the United States now, to be most clearly centered in the black political arena. But clearly also a vision of a public sector that needs lots and lots of work and lots of different directions. And I think an emerging interest in a public sector that is not centralist, that doesn't mean that everything has to go through Washington, D.C., that all the decisions are top down. I think there's an emerging kind of decentralist politics coming out of the black community that is terrifically interesting. Okay, so those are some of the variables, I think, that we see as we look at the black political scene as centered in black mayors. Let me just say a couple of things about what difference it might make, and then let's talk for a few minutes if we can. I think that the emergence of blacks into public officialdom is terrifically significant, even when there are very few. The 9 in Minnesota out of 19,000, I think, makes a huge difference. Think about those of you who've been around Holden in the last 9 or 10 days. Think about the difference that the presence of a few black folks meant up here. It seems to me that particularly at any public policy kind of level, even the presence of 2 or 3 black folks changes the discussion significantly, allows more kinds of considerations to get onto the table, shifts the perception of the interests that are represented there significantly. So I think even when you're in situations where there are just a few people of color around, things have shifted significantly. If there are some more people of color around, the chances are that some opportunity for mobilizing some political power and actually affecting the policy direction of whatever body you're dealing with, some opportunity for mobilizing political power begins to exist someplace around I don't know, 15-20% black representation, probably. So that second level, besides just being at the table and influencing the discussion a little bit, is a level of black participation at the table in some cities, in some city councils, in some legislatures, that begins to be able to build majority coalitions beyond themselves. And then finally, in those situations like the cities I've been talking about, where power is held significant at even understanding the limits of municipal power, where power is held by blacks, lots of things can begin to change. Substantial benefits can begin to accrue to those at the bottom of the ladder. Policies can shift so that many more people are involved in their formation, coming to the table to try to figure out what the directions are. You've got services to give, you've got some hiring stuff to do, you've got some contracts to let, you've got a whole tone with the business community to set, you've got lots and lots of stuff to buy and to seed economic activity with. You've got a set of influences on social welfare policy. So you got a whole lot range of stuff that you can do when you begin to think about power at the municipal level. So much so that the final thing I'll say is that some people who are looking at black mayoralties think that there really is a new kind of urban government coming into being now, that the old machine government and what replaced the old machine governments in most cities was a sort of corporate-based reform government where efficiency was held up as the ultimate value. The efficiency is sort of, you know, you general motorize your city government with a lot of sort of corporate managers. This is the technocratic model. Those are the two major types of urban government that we've lived with in the United States for the past 150 years. It may be that the black mayors are bringing something new onto the stage. One of my friends in Chicago has begun to call it status reform governments, not reform just in the sense of making it efficient like a business corporation, but reform that has at its center questions of fairness, questions of equity, questions of social justice. And if you think about the old reform governments as being modeled on the corporations, what are they most like? They're like corporations with that kind of a hierarchy. A status reform government might be most like a black church, with some kind of both style and substance that comes out of a movement kind of mentality. So it could be that there's something significantly new happening in American cities. And it could be that the regeneration, it seems to me, at a moral and ethical level of discussion of public policy in the United States, if it's going to happen at all, is going to happen with the impetus from the black community leading it. Now, we may want to talk about that some. You may want to talk a little bit about Jesse Jackson. I haven't talked much about Jesse. Let me just stop and let's open it up and see where you want to go with any other.
I'd just like to ask a clarification question. On the West Coast, most of the city governments elect your representatives and then you also vote on the budget. So you have two different things to take place. And just because the city council sets up an agenda, you cannot necessarily carry it out because the populace as a whole has the first strength. Is that different? I mean, I understand that there are different types of city governments in other parts of the country. Is that different in Illinois and New York and so on, so that once they're elected, they then have the charter to move forward on what they want to do?
Yeah, I think the other major model is that there's some kind of a give and take between the elected legislative body and the executive on the budget making. It's not common off the West Coast to have people actually voting on the budget.
So
it goes through the city council.
Okay, once you do your representatives on there, and something can happen.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You don't have to send everything back to referendum all the time. Anybody want to talk about Jesse in the context of all this and that? You know, from my point of view, from just what I've said here, my interest in Jesse Jackson primarily, there are lots of reasons to be interested in what he's doing and try to figure out what it is. But one major interest for me is the is the generation of energy at the local level in black communities. You know, you can point to place after place after place where Jesse's last campaign energized local candidacies and local movements of the black community into the political arena where they're never, you know, Prince George's County in right outside of Washington, D.C. is a good example. Never had any blacks involved in party politics there or in government, and now has a number of black elected officials and lots of activity where nothing, and basically that was because Jackson went through there about five or six times, you know. So there is that kind of spillover to the local level that seems to me one clear residue of his running. He's got a lot more in mind than simply winning or losing. He understands the complexity and the dynamics of being a movement leader as well as a sort of narrowly defined politician, and I think for that reason he thinks about lots more than simply winning and losing stuff. He also seems to me to, I mean, just by his presence, he shifts the locus of the discussion, right? When Jackson's around, when any black politicians are around dealing with foreign policy, you cannot ignore South Africa. I mean, another reason to be interested in the public presence of the black community is that it carries with it, at the very center of its consciousness, the question of South Africa. You know, in ways that, for instance, the Reagan administration doesn't like to deal with at all. I mean, it's, you know, Reagan would just assume that the whole Southern Africa question would go away. But you can't do that when the black politicians are around. So Jesse does that, it seems to me.
Just one comment that I've noticed, and it disturbs me greatly, is that in a lot of especially the periodicals that you'll read, they will preface a man's name or position with his color. Mm-hmm. The black mayor of Chicago, Harold Washington, says this. Mm-hmm. Or Tom Bradley is the black mayor of Los Angeles. And that disturbs me that the color is ever brought up. Or the Hispanic mayor of San Antonio says this and that. And it's too bad that they ever mention the color. Just let's talk the issues, if that's the case, or his comments, and leave his color, his race, out of it. And I think people would be a lot more open to accepting or not accepting the issue and not the color of the skin.
Yeah, I'm of two minds about that. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I think the other side of the coin, though, is that if we really do want to understand the dynamics of political life in the United States, we absolutely have to look at it through racial lenses. That there is an expression of public life that comes out of the black community that is the black community's expression of public life, right? And insofar as Washington shapes and leads that, it is incredibly important that he is black. Now, how to deal with that in the public media is another sort of set of questions, but I'm just saying that acknowledging the different views of the world that come out of the black, Hispanic, white populations, and, you know, variations within those populations, is real important to do. You know, Cisneros, we could do a whole other session on Latino politics. I think both Pena in Denver and Cisneros in San Antonio are very interesting characters, and are doing a lot of similar kind of reshaping of the Hispanic community's political life that the black mayors are doing in terms of the black community's political life.
My last comment, I think people like Wilson Good or Tom Bradley, Harold Washington, whatever, are good for the young blacks because they can see that they can make it in the system. And I think that it's too bad about Harold Washington not paying taxes for 20 years and this kind of stuff.
Wait a minute, he paid, he didn't file. Difference.
Well, okay, that's the U.S. Congress to do that while he's in office.
It's 5 years.
But in any case, I think it offers hope to the young black to see, hey, the system does work. Difficult at times, but it does work. I think it offers hope.
Yeah, I think, let me push it a little further. I think that the models, so another way of saying what I'm trying to say here, is that the models that these people present are very different models. I think there's a different lesson to be learned from Tom Bradley than from a Harold Washington, not having anything to do with the tax stuff.
Yeah, right.
You know, the Bradley lesson is, look, if you get technically adept, if you learn how to manage, if you learn how to sort of do it within the white system, you really can get a lot of support across racial lines. And I think that's an important lesson. But it's also a limited lesson. I think Washington, on the other hand, says, look, you can be race conscious, you can be self-consciously black, and still build a politics that is a coalition politics that builds beyond the black community, that adds white support, Hispanic support, Asian support. That's a very different kind of lesson for young kids to learn. In fact, I think most young black kids in cities find somebody like Harold Washington a lot more interesting than a... Do other people sort of share the sense of hope that I have about some of this stuff? I mean, am I just sort of way off? I guess it's a little hard from Holden Village, but Anne, yeah,
well,
New York.
I was going to ask you a comment on the state of New York City politics.
Well, I don't know. They're all in jail, aren't they? Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, from a distance, I'm not inside.
Stand, yeah. On some level, even with the overpowering presence of Ed Koch.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not. I don't get to New York more than a couple times a year, and I'm not on the inside of it at all. But my impression certainly is that since the death of Adam Clayton Powell, there is no black political leader in New York City who has emerged to gather the various kind of constituencies and forces together. I mean, you know, when you're in one of these things, you understand how absolutely variable the black community is. So when we think sometimes about the black community as a monolith, it's just not. There's all kinds of pulls and tensions and forces and stuff, and it's no mean trick to try to pull together the complexities within the black community in around some kind of a candidacy. And, you know, that was just very exciting to watch Washington do that in Chicago. I don't think that... even though from the outside it has looked to me like Ed Koch in New York has been very vulnerable at a number of times in the last 6 or 8 years, it's frustrating to not see somebody that the whole thing can coalesce around.
On the congressional level.
Think so?
Senator, in San Antonio has been pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Got to expose some white, upper middle class high school kids to inner city San Antonio youth.
Mm-hmm.
And just them talking to them has been very exciting. You know, they're excited about having a Hispanic mayor. And also, there seems to be a lot of good grassroots stuff happening in San Antonio.
That's right. The cops thing, you know, about
cops.
And, yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things that's interesting when you get a mayor that's sort of ideologically oriented and comes out of a movement thing that's black or Hispanic particularly, is you've got a whole new inside-outside set of dynamics going on. The whole community organization movement in the United States that's flowered over the last 20 years. It's about neighborhood power building and about participatory democracy kind of stuff. When you get one of those progressive black or Hispanic mayors in there, the back and forth between the neighborhoods and the downtown gets very exciting. And that's happening, I think, in San Antonio, where the community organizations are very strong. And there's a grassroots sort of set of institutions that hold people accountable. I mean, nobody in a mayor's chair can do what he wants to do, particularly for poor people, without a lot of pressure that helps him do it. That's the way politics works, and it's the same way with Washington and Chicago.
Well, the good thing about San Antonio, too, that's really, I think, very, very hopeful, is that in the case of the mayor down there, where the mayor is positioned, it's a non-paying job.
Yeah.
And his wife has to work to pay the rent.
Yes.
He does gets no compensation whatsoever.
Okay.
And that was one of the, I spent some time in San Antonio, and that was one of the reasons why it was held by the white man. It was generally a very wealthy one.
Yeah.
He could afford to take a sabbatical
sure.
3 years, 6 years, whatever. But he had industrial money or real estate, whatever. Because it's a non-paying job.
Sure.
And this is why he lives, I believe, in a rented apartment.
Yeah, I think that's right.
San Antonio doesn't own a home because there's no money. And his wife is, I think, a school teacher or a part-time employee at one of the public jobs,
mm-hmm.
nurse, whatever, because there's no money coming in.
Well, it's break time. Thank you all.
Thank you. 20 years, he didn't pay his taxes. But he just didn't.
Again, he paid everything. It ended up, I know that.
No,
he was paying all the time. He never owed the government any money. All he forgot to do was to file.
The guy, President General Electric, did that 5 years ago and had to resign.
Yeah, so. I mean, as I was saying the other day, his problem is he doesn't care. He just doesn't care about his personal finances at all. He has no idea where his checkbook is at any given moment.
Yeah. Very enlightening.
A quick question on one of your statistics.
Sure.
Without a bias, but just following it through.
Sure.
If I were to look at, when I take a first glance at this statistic right here,
mm-hmm.
I say 10% of the population, voting population, and you got to be talking about older people also.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's probably even less, but yeah. I mean, you're talking about 10% of the population. 40 people, okay,
right.
would be what you would, if you were to have a cross section, that would be your expectation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You take into the fact that economically, there's got to be far fewer than 5%
sure.
of the people with the skills and the expertise to manage many of those jobs.
Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be Republicans.
And they wouldn't be Republicans.
That's right. That's right.
I hate to say
this. You're saying this looks astounding.
Why do you use that? That to me looks astounding. Why do people point to that and say that it's so terrible?
And how many are women? I mean, if you look at minorities, they include women. Hispanics.
Well, I think
and black.
You can't talk about minorities. It's women, though.
No.
Reagan is no saint. But when I see that statistic,
to me,
I'm impressed.
To me, anything. This has to be put up against previous administrations.
Yeah,
both Carter and Nixon.